The perils of looking for lessons from history in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan will be the Vietnam for them. I want to tell you clearly, we will win and they will die.
A Taliban spokesman speaking to CNN first evokes Vietnam in referring to NATO forces in Afghanistan, and then moments later goes back 10 centuries in time to evoke the Crusades.
Our jihad is against the Crusader. We do not want to kill civilians. We ask of the civilians, don't be close to the troops, be away from them, not to be targeted.
History may be no decoder ring for the events unfolding in Afghanistan, where navigating uncharted waters requires fluency in languages other than English. Decoding Afghanistan? Hey Toto, we're not in Vietnam anymore on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, November 5th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. We're also going to talk about there was a little game in the Bronx last night that some people are talking about this morning. We're going to bring some much-needed attention to that game. Also, the president is meeting with 574 tribal leaders today. How do you have a significant conversation with 574 people? We'll talk about that, too.
But first, Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Christine, how perilous is history, like, say, Vietnam, as the Taliban suggested there, as any guide to the events unfolding now in Afghanistan?
Absolutely perilous. It's not remotely clear that in terms of the military operations that Vietnam in any way, shape, or form resembles what's going on in Afghanistan. I would argue there is another parallel that's going around, and that is the parallel to what happened in Iraq and the so-called Sunni uprising to justify the raising of militias. It's not remotely clear that the surge had anything to do with the Iraqis rising up and tossing out a largely foreign al-Qaeda presence from their country.
All right, historical parallels and the perils of following them too closely. In just a moment, we'll have that discussion. Christine Fair, stay with us. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, more news on Afghanistan. The UN says it's temporarily moving 600 of its staff out of the country because of concerns for their safety. Five UN workers were killed in an attack in Kabul last week. And the Yankees have won it all again. The team defeated the Phillies 7-3 last night to win the World Series. It's the Yankees' 27th time winning the championship title. In Washington, the House could vote as early as today on a bill that would extend unemployment benefits for up to 20 weeks. The measure would also expand a tax credit for first-time homebuyers. The Senate passed the measure unanimously yesterday.
Two quick auto stories. GM is confirming it will cut 10,000 jobs at its European subsidiary Opel. Trade unions in Germany have called strikes. Toyota, the world's largest automaker, announced today it had earned a profit of $242 million last quarter after three straight quarterly losses. The Dow opens today at 9802. The S&P starts trading at 1047. The NASDAQ kicks off at 2056. Give a suggestion to the Republicans on health care reform.
My name is Guy. I'm from Minnesota. I'm wondering why they don't toss this health care bill, go and do something like the German model, where health insurance is nonprofit and companies make their profit selling ancillary coverages such as life, home, and auto coverage.
Give a suggestion to the minority Republican alternative health care reform plan at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. You know, I wonder if listeners share a frustration that we face when we do stories on Afghanistan almost every morning, it seems.
Yeah.
That, you know, to understand where events in Afghanistan are leading, you always, it seems, have to reconcile some pretty extreme positions. You can just take politics as
right.
an example. Okay, we've got a president, new presidential government, new political future, right? You got this rosy view of Afghan politics from Hamid Karzai.
My government will be for all Afghans. And all those who want to work with me are most welcome, regardless of whether they opposed me in the election or whether they supported me in the election.
Let's start fresh, says Hamid Karzai,
right.
the newly named president. But there is no future, basically, if you listen to the views of Abdullah Abdullah, the chief opposition leader at Afghanistan.
To hope that the same government will deliver in dealing with corruption, issues of governance, bringing security in this country, it sounds like an exaggeration.
It's fair to say he's not optimistic. And finally, optimism is not a part of this dark suggestion from a spokesman for the Taliban who spoke with the CNN last summer.
This is the war of martyrdom. Don't worry about this. We want to fight. We want to fight for martyrdom.
So reconciling these sharply divergent pictures of how to proceed in Afghanistan is complicated by ethnic and tribal tensions that are far more complex than what we learned about in Iraq, the Sunni-Shiite conflicts that created all the bloody chaos in Iraq. So all of this bleakness is motivated, I think, by a discussion that we had earlier this week. You remember?
Comparing
American decision-making in Vietnam to the decision-making in the Afghan war. A lot of people online and elsewhere responded to our discussion, and it motivated us to ask this morning, is history something of a bubble that distorts rather than informs? For instance, to get some interesting reactions to our Vietnam conversation and peer in the other direction entirely, we were joined earlier this morning by Lise Doucette, BBC correspondent in Kabul. Also, Junaid Sharif is a professor at Payne College in Augusta, Georgia, where he teaches the Pashto language. He is himself Afghan-American. And let's start with you, Professor. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to thank you for helping to motivate this conversation, because it was you who wrote in and said about our conversation regarding the Vietnam lessons for decision makers in Afghanistan. You are comparing the Taliban, vicious and medieval, to the Viet Cong, you wrote to us in an email, who were fighting for progress and national liberation. The Viet Cong were supported by half of the world, you said. I have yet to come across anyone who openly endorses the Taliban. You going to help us out this morning, Junaid?
Going to try.
All right. And also with us, of course, Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, a friend of the Takeaway, who spoke there at the top saying Vietnam is a perilous parallel thinking about Afghanistan. Christine, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lise Doucette, let's get an update. First of all, the violence recently in Afghanistan has caused the United Nations to make a decision. They're moving away from vulnerable areas. First of all, what do you make of the UN's decision this morning?
Came back from the United Nations compound, and they're very much taking pains to say this is a temporary move. They're going to take out half of their staff, some 600 people, the unessential staff, they say, and I think but whether or not any of them are not essential is a moot point. But they have to make some changes to their security environment here. They have some 93 guest houses scattered across the city, and coming after that very brutal attack by the Taliban, which killed several UN workers, they now believe they've got to have a better security operation here if they're going to protect their staff, because the staff here were also feeling very vulnerable. A number of them said they wanted to leave. They didn't feel safe here. But of course, for Afghans, this sends a very negative signal. They're saying, if the UN is leaving, what about us? Is security really that bad? The UN says they're coming back, and everyone here hopes they do, because that will send a signal that it is still safe for Afghans to be here and for the international community.
Well, before you joined us, Lise, we quoted a Taliban spokesman who spoke with CNN last summer and mentioned that Afghanistan will be NATO's Vietnam, making explicitly the comparison of Vietnam. I'm wondering, if, as you look at the situation on the ground in Afghanistan with your long history in South Asia, if Vietnam is any kind of a lesson as you look at the different tensions and rivalries that exist in Afghanistan right now.
You know, I'm not the best person to ask about this, because everyone is invoking history. What do you call Afghanistan? Afghanistan, graveyard of empires. Afghanistan, the place where, you know, Hindu Kush, this formidable landscape, formidable people, as if somehow mountains and men are destiny. I think it stops us from looking at Afghanistan on its own terms. Mm-hmm. Afghanistan has its own particular history. Afghanistan has its own people. Afghanistan has its own complexity. Why are you adding the complexity of Southeast Asia? And besides, we already know what happened in Vietnam. We don't know what is going to happen here.
Very good point. Junaid Sharif, professor at Payne College in Augusta, Georgia. What is it that we need to know about the rivalries that exist on the ground, do you think, to make intelligent decisions about policy in Afghanistan?
Okay, before I get to the rivalries, can I just respond to the Vietnam thing? Or
Sure, go right ahead.
Well, you summarized my position pretty good, but, you know, I'm basically a literary critic, and I also teach English, not just Pashto. But to me, I'm a student of history also, and to me it seems very unfair to bring up something like Vietnam into the decision making. Now, it's okay to put it in a history book or in a lecture, but I'm basically saying that the Viet Cong and Hanoi, for that matter, were standing for change. They were historically on the side of progress, on the side of creating a nation. But here you have the Taliban who have no social, no political agenda, no economic agenda, absolutely. The only agenda they have is socio-cultural. And they want to just burn schools and destroy education. So I just think that it is unfair to make that comparison.
All right, let's get a comment from Christine Fair. Is Junaid Sharif making a fair characterization of the Taliban as a reactionary throwback with no political agenda in Afghanistan, Christine Fair?
I mean, largely I agree with everything that your other guests have said and really don't have anything to add. The only parallel that perhaps has any relevance is the fact that every war we've had, certainly since I've been an adult, has been paralleled to Vietnam. And I think the issue that we're really getting at when we talk about Vietnam is not the particularities of the conflict per se, but rather a trend of increasing public opposition to the war and putting pressure upon policymakers sitting in Congress and also in the White House to make different decisions. I mean, that's the only parallel that has any relevance. There's nothing to do with Vietnam in terms of the social, cultural, and political context of the conflict.
But, you know, Christine, is there a danger here for many of our military decision makers who, if they didn't actively participate in the Vietnam War, have a very strong memory of it, is there a danger that they're going to make comparisons that will lead to mistaken choices in the strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, the odd thing is I've never met a military officer or enlisted person that served in Afghanistan make that parallel. This is a parallel that commentators and some politicians are making. I've never heard this parallel come from the military.
Mm. That's interesting. Junaid Sharif, do you think there's something narcissistic about the constant evocations of Vietnam? And if you would, let's talk about the rivalries. Let's talk about how this needs to be assessed from the ground in Afghanistan.
Well, about the rivalries, I heard Abdullah talk to his followers last night on Afghan media, and his tone was very conciliatory. He represents a coalition, but as a person, he himself, I have to give him the credit. He is a seasoned politician, and he has the wisdom to control the excesses of whatever frustrations there might be. There is, of course, Afghanistan is regionally oriented. There are tendencies, tensions. They have been there, but there is a myth among the journalists and pundits that Afghanistan has never had a central government. That is simply not true.
Yeah, interesting point.
And so if we have had a central government since at least the beginning of the 1900s...
Right, and it included a monarchy and the central government that was in place before the Soviet invasion. We're running out of time here, Junaid. Thanks so much. Let me just end with Lise Doucette, who's in Kabul. Do you think Abdullah, taking Junaid's point there, has a chance to be a political leader, even though he's out of the government at this point?
Well, there is no opposition structure in Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai is against the development of formal political parties. There are no opposition benches here, no sense of a loyal opposition. I think the personal relationship between him and Hamid Karzai is quite difficult now. Possibly some of his allies will make it into the government. He'll always be around. He always keeps a foot in all camps. But right now, he's not looking for a role in government.
Well, that was Lise Doucette, the BBC correspondent in Afghanistan. Junaid Sharif, a professor at Payne College in Augusta, Georgia, where he teaches Pashto and English. And Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. They all joined us earlier this morning for this discussion about the perils of historic parallels in evaluating Afghanistan. Thanks for that discussion to all of you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following today. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen's here. I don't know why. It's kind of a quiet day in sports yesterday. Not much going on except this.
To the second baseman, Cano. The Yankees are back on top. world champions for the 27th time.
Ibrahim, you must be happy this morning. A great game for the Yankees last night. Not an especially exciting game.
It was it was an exciting game if you were a Yankees fan.
Or you were Japanese.
If you were, right. Indeed. And if you were a Phillies fan, I just want to make a point about the Phillies manager, Charlie Manuel, who handled defeat with such grace and in such an honorable manner. It made you wonder if Joe Girardi would actually handle defeat in the same way. And I don't think he would have. So I think one of the heroes last night was Charlie Manuel.
We should say that the Yankees won 7-3 last night. They are the World Series champions once again. And you're pointing to the manager. Well, I would think there was a big case for that Matsui was the hero of last night's game, though.
Without a doubt. And I think but you also have to remember, I mean, Matsui drove in 6 runs. And
right.
Designated hitter, which proves, you know, the dominance of AL baseball. But I think you have to go back a little bit also to the 7th inning when it was Chase Utley versus Damaso Marte, and it was the bridge to Mariano Rivera, who's the all-everything closer, the legendary closer. And Damaso Marte got Chase Utley, who had 5 home runs in this whole series. He got him in 3 pitches. He struck him out. And then in the top in the 8th inning, he got Howard, who had homered in the 6th inning with a 2-run homer, had broke his streak of ineptitude, and then Damaso Marte struck him out. So I think that there was he wanted some of the unsung heroes, Damaso Marte.
Bullpens ruled, yeah.
The Yankees winning for their first time, their first year in their brand new $1.5 billion stadium. And here's a question actually for the listeners, because before we went on the air this morning, we couldn't find the answer to this. It hasn't been totally tracked. How many other teams have done that? Any idea?
And that's a good question.
In their brand new stadium?
I think it's great to push that back.
I bet that some of our sports fanatics out there will be able to find this out.
I'll tell you, the Yankees did it in 1923.
Right.
So the another thing we have to remember is the how the Phillies got here. The Phillies won 93 games. They won the World Series last year.
Yeah.
They won the NL East for 3 years in a row. The Yankees won 103 games. They won the AL East. Both of their roads to this point were very similar. They were slugging, good pitching, very gritty teams that came from behind and got tough wins, and this is where they met. It was a beautiful, beautiful night in the
Except
Bronx.
One spent a little more. That's from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And if you want to be able to help us answer that trivia question, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
Our next takeout, we go to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So Todd, 98-0, a vote in the Senate. There's some bipartisanship. What's going on?
Yeah, 98-0, but it's a little bit misleading. This is kind of a good news, bad news story, John. So why not start off with the good news? The Senate yesterday voted to extend. This is good news for the economy and for unemployed people and for anyone shopping for a home, for the housing market. The Senate voted to extend federal unemployment benefits for thousands of people who are out of jobs by 14 additional weeks. It's already been extended by about 60 weeks. So this is another 14 weeks for people in most states, plus an additional 6 weeks, so 20 in total for anybody who lives in a state with a jobless rate over 8.5%. So that's help for lots and lots of people out there who've lost their jobs and still need their federal unemployment benefits extended. On the home buyer front, the Senate also extended the first-time home buyer tax credit. Back with the stimulus, John, you'll remember that they put a home buyer tax credit in there, $8,000.
Sure. It's kind of the cash for clunkers for housing program.
Well, it's exactly what it was, and the danger of not extending it is, you know, the housing market's really shaky still, and if you don't extend that, you know, it runs the risk of teetering. So $8,000 in most cases, and that was due to expire at the end of this month, threatening the housing market. They've extended that another 9 months.
I'm not hearing any bad news.
Actually, there is some, and here's what it is. Look, 98-0, there's the vote. The Senate could have done this weeks ago, if not for partisan bickering, you know, Republicans demanding votes on this UI bill on things like ACORN, things like immigration policy that are politically charged, other things. Democrats, Harry Reid, absolutely refusing to give in on any votes that he didn't want to take. They could have had this done weeks ago. Listen quickly to John Thune, a Republican. He's a chairman of the Senate Republican Policy Committee.
It's convenient for him to blame Republicans for not having UI done, but UI could have been done last week if he had been willing to have a reasonable number of Republican amendments that we get to pick and not that he picks. And I think that's the fundamental issue here, is he wants to tell us which amendments we can offer and which ones we can get voted on.
Now, UI is not a urological term. That means unemployment insurance, right?
Unemployment yeah. insurance. And what right. Thune is talking about is he can't tell us what to vote on. He can't tell us what we get to vote on. We get to pick him. This was partisan bickering while Americans are suffering with unemployment. John, whoever was right and whoever was wrong in this, I have to say, not the Senate's proudest moment.
All right, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
I hear UI and think user interface, John.
Okay.
Now let's go to business and with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner in the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning. So before you ask me what I think you're going to ask me, let's step back for a second and talk about the Yankees because
yes. Right?
Yes. They can be an economic indicator as well.
Right.
So I saw some numbers last night from Standard & Poor's Capital IQ about the 22 past World Series since 1936 that the Yankees have won. And after that, the stock market has returned 10% on average. So maybe...
Interesting.
In the year after?
And get this, when it went to six games, like it did in this case, it's returned 15%.
Oh, wow.
So, that's euphoria from all the Yankees
serious.
Fans on right. Wall Street, right. I think.
Right. The futures just bounced up on Louise's story.
Either
talking
that
about
or they
that.
Were up too late last night watching the game, yep. and so they're not really paying attention to what they're doing, maybe. But what we brought you here to talk about today was the stimulus package and perhaps
yep.
some sketchy statistics
yep.
and how we came up with those jobs, those 650,000 jobs that the White House said were either saved or created by the stimulus package.
Yep. So some of my colleagues have been digging into the reports that were filed on this website, recovery.gov, that was set up to track these jobs. And they found some really fishy things. For instance, they found a Kentucky shoe store that reported that it had created 9 jobs simply because of an $890 check from the stimulus for work boots. So you got to wonder what those 9 people are being paid for an $890 order. There are tons of examples like these. And so I called the White House last night and said, you know, what's going on here? These numbers seem a little fishy. Can you do your math? And what a spokeswoman there told me is that this is unprecedented transparency that they're providing this at all. There's never been a government effort
right.
to provide this much transparency.
And so quit questioning it, right? Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much. Coming up...
Transparency means bad math,
since
I
we're
guess,
speaking yeah. of the White House, 574 Native Americans and Alaskan Native leaders going to the White House today. This hasn't happened since the Clinton era, but is it important or is it a massive photo opportunity requiring a wide-angle lens, I guess? What are they going to talk about? We'll talk about that.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk with three people who are meeting with the president. It is the first meeting of the sitting president and native people of the country for 15 years. More on that in a few moments. But first, here's some news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. The New York Yankees, champions again. They won the World Series in the Bronx last night, beating the Phillies in Game 6 with a score of 7-3.
And the government has just issued the latest number of new claims for unemployment, 512,000. That's a decline of 20,000. Also, productivity figures for the third quarter came out. Productivity in the U.S. economy is up almost 10%. In Afghanistan, the United Nations says it will temporarily move half of its staff out of the country because of safety concerns. Meanwhile, there are reports of a NATO airstrike on civilians in the south of Afghanistan. And those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
The second thing we have to do is to make sure that we are not just having a Bureau of Indian Affairs that are dealing with the various Native American tribes. We've got to have the President of the United States, who is meeting on a regular basis with the leadership and ensuring that there's relationships of dignity and respect.
That's candidate Obama making promises to Native Americans in Elko, Nevada in 2008. Beginning today, President Obama might be making good on that campaign promise to have regular meetings with tribal leaders. Today's White House Tribal Nations Conference is the first in 15 years in which indigenous American leaders have been invited to the White House. It hasn't happened since Bill Clinton was in office. We're joined now by three guests in Washington, D.C. who are attending that conference. Ivan Posey is the chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe on the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. Wyoming. Dr. Yvette Rubidoux is the Director of Indian Health Services for the Department of Health and Human Services. She's also a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And Victor Marino is a Senior Correspondent, Special Projects Editor for ResNet, a Native American and Indigenous Issues website. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Ivan, let me start with you first. This is the first time, as we said, in 15 years that tribal leaders have had any one-on-one access with the president. And you represent the Shoshone Nation in Wyoming. What are the concerns you're bringing to the president today? And do you have any guarantees that you're going to see him one-on-one? There's going to be 574 leaders there.
Well, yes. There are several concerns I'd like to voice with our president. First of all, I'd like to say we're very grateful that he has decided to be with us. There is a lot of people here waiting in line to get this opportunity. And over the last few days, we've had several listening conferences with several federal agencies regarding some of the issues that face in the country.
Is that unusual today, to have those meetings with the federal agencies?
We have that round table with the HHS. With the Department of Agriculture, with the Department of Labor. So I think the direction that the administration's given to the president is to take Indian tribes seriously. So we're very enthused by that.
Okay.
Many problems are common regarding Indian country. I'm hoping that this will be an ongoing effort through this administration to hear our concerns, to live up to the obligations that the United States has to Indian tribes, and to have some meaningful measures on how those services and promises are delivered.
Okay, that's even Ivan Posey. He's the chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe. And Dr. Yvette Rubidoux, you heard Ivan saying that many problems among all these tribes, and as I said, there's 574 leaders headed to the White House today, are common. A common complaint among any tribes is about health care. And this is President Obama, while he was still a candidate in Nevada, talking about that.
On every indicator, health, life expectancy, substance abuse, Native Americans are at the bottom. And that's not just an embarrassment for the U.S. government, that's an embarrassment for all of us.
Yvette, you are the Director of Indian Health Services for the Department of Health and Human Services. Are we going to see a change, an actual real change in policy that will deal with what he was just talking about?
Yes, I believe we will see, because President Obama has set the tone from the top that he wants us to honor the government-to-government relationship with our tribes and to deal with many of their concerns and issues in a way that has meaning and has outcomes. I'm the director of the Indian Health Service. We've heard loud and clear that the tribes want better access to quality of care, and that's what we're going to try to do over the next few years.
Okay, let's go to Victor Marina, a senior correspondent for ResNet. Victor, Ivan said that many of the concerns among all these tribes are very similar, but we're dealing with 574 independent governments, independent organizations all over the country, all over the map. How many of these things are going to be so individual, so specific to the specific tribes that it's going to be very difficult for them to deal with? And how would you get at that at a big mass meeting like this?
Well, it may be difficult because, in fact, I was talking to some of the tribal leaders, and each of them came up with some specific point they wanted to make and one concern about their tribe that they wanted to bring to the attention of the president. So I think he and his administration will face these individual concerns, but also collectively, what I've heard in talking to a number of the tribal leaders this week and in the past is that there are some common concerns that they have.
Like?
Common concerns talking about sovereignty, that is continuing, that there's a overhaul of the federal acknowledgement or federal recognition of tribes process, which has taken so long, as long as 30 years in some cases, for tribes to be federally recognized.
So, Victor, give me a sense of how emotional this meeting is going to be. I mean, there's a long history of Native Americans being paraded through Washington for one reason or another, and not all of that history is something that we would be proud of. But what's emotional about this particular meeting?
Well, last night I was at the museum, the American Indian, National Museum of American Indian, and it was almost like a rally because everyone had gathered for a reception that was co-sponsored by the National Congress of American Indians. And I remember standing there next to a tribal chief who just marveled as he looked around and said, so many Indians in one place. And there was that real feel of buoyancy and the fact that they are indeed having an historic moment. It's great to have this one-on-one with the president, but the real proof is going to be, as Ivan Posey has said, if there's an ongoing relationship
right.
with the administration and what happens next.
Whether or not this is the first step. Ivan, is this a first step? Have you heard from the White House that there will be further meetings, more concrete meetings in the future?
I have heard that. I haven't heard that officially. I would hope that would be the case.
Ivan Posey is the chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming. Dr. Yvette Roubidoux, the director of Indian Health Services for the Department of Health and Human Services, and a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Nation. And Victor Marina is the senior correspondent editor and special projects editor for ResNet. Coming up, a video game every day will maybe keep you healthier and maybe smarter, John.
Unemployed, possibly. Or maybe employed. Actually, what if you put on your resume, okay, that you're really good at some video games?
I could do that. Yeah. I'm very good at least one video game.
Maybe you guys should try that out there in the recession, okay? That's what we're going to talk about in a minute. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Most people have heard news reports of the 50-year-old registered sex offender Anthony Sowell. He was formally charged with murder and rape yesterday in Ohio's Cuyahoga County Court. But what's still capturing the headlines are the details of how Sowell was caught living amongst at least 10 of his victims' corpses. Joining us to talk about this now is Dan Malthrop. He's host of WCPN Sound of Ideas, Cleveland Public Radio's public affairs program, and to give us details about this. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
Can you tell us what is Sowell actually being accused? What is he being charged with?
He was charged yesterday with 5 counts of aggravated murder, and then there are also, in an unrelated case, he's being charged with kidnapping, assault, and rape. That's a victim who I believe she's the one who alerted authorities to the fact that he was a danger. And that actually happened in September. It wasn't until just before Halloween that Sowell was apprehended.
Now, we've heard reports that there's at least 10 bodies that they've recovered. Why is he only being charged with 5 counts of murder?
I think it's because they're still doing a lot of forensic analysis. They announced yesterday that they had found 10 bodies and 1 skull. They've announced that that is actually an 11th victim. The details are coming fairly slowly here as they do analysis and as they try to identify the victims. They've only identified 1 of the 11 victims so far. That's 53-year-old Tanya Carmichael, who disappeared from Warrensville Heights. That's a nearby suburb a little over a year ago. And the details are coming very slowly. They've released information that 7 victims were found with some sort of they were cords around their neck. They believe that these victims were strangled with. He has used extension cords and neckties in the past. Other victims were strangled with his hands. They believe.
This case is unique in a couple ways. Number one, we're not used to hearing of a serial killer who's African American. This is also the first serial killer in Cleveland, and I'm wondering what are you hearing from residents there in reaction to this story.
He's not the first serial killer in Cleveland. A long time ago when Elliot Ness was our director of public safety, he battled with a serial killer known as the Torso Murderer. But the residents are really just, they don't know how this happened. There was a stench in that neighborhood of what people now know was rotting bodies. People thought it was a dead dog that had been hit by a car or the sausage shop on the corner or something like that. They complained to the city, but they do not know how this – there's a lot of questions about how this was able to happen and how this why nobody investigated earlier.
Especially since he was a registered sex offender.
Especially since he was a registered sex offender. He had served 15 years in prison for a rape and assault in East Cleveland.
And they're expecting to actually gut his home and do more digging. Is this mean they're expecting to possibly find more victims quickly?
I think they would not be surprised if they found more, but they are going to do an exhaustive search through the rest of his house, and they're also searching vacant homes that are nearby.
Oh, Dan Moulthorp is the program host of The Sound Ideas on WCPN, Cleveland Public Radio. He joined us from Cleveland talking about 50-year-old registered sex offender Anthony Soule. He was arraigned yesterday on 5 counts of murder. So far, they've found 10 bodies in and around his property and one which may be evidence of an 11th victim.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And I think all of us have some advice on how to get your day going right. That's right. I mean, what if you got a good dose of Super Mario or some other video game every morning to start your day? It just might be good for your health. We're going to talk about that seriously in just a few minutes. Speaking of health, House Republicans are releasing an alternative to the Democratic health care bill this week. Tell us what you want to see in a final bill.
Hi, this is Rich from Boston. So what I want to see in the health care bill is a public option.
And at 877-8-MY-TAKE, send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are collecting your suggestions. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Some economic indicators just in this hour out. We learned that 512,000 people claimed jobless benefits last week for the first time. That's a bigger drop than expected, about 20,000. Meanwhile, productivity rose at a rate of nearly 10% in the last quarter. Individual retailers are beginning to report their October sales this morning. The wholesaler Costco says its sales rose 5%, but the company that owns Victoria's Secret and Bath and Body Works is reporting a bigger than expected drop.
The automaker General Motors is confirming it will cut 10,000 jobs at its European subsidiary Opel. And meanwhile, Toyota announced today it earned a profit of $242 million last quarter. That's after 3 straight quarterly losses. The U.S. says it will not lift its sanctions on the country of Myanmar, known as Burma. That's despite a new policy of engagement with the country. And looking ahead to tomorrow, the Yankees can head down town for the city's ticker tape parade for the New York Yankees. The team won against the Philadelphia Phillies last night, 7-3, clinching their 27th World Series title. So look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yes, on Tech Thursday, we call it. I'm thinking, maybe call it daydreaming, about how there's a real generational split regarding video games. I mean, my parents are of the pinball era, where arcade games equal juvenile delinquency and time-wasting, basically. Me, I'm solidly a child of the 70s and 80s, where being good at a video game just might qualify you to join an intergalactic army of heroes to save the universe.
It started with a game, but it wasn't just any game. One night,
we have to talk about a matter of utmost importance. I've seen him come and I've seen him go, but you're the best, my boy. Light years ahead of the competition.
Yes. The Last Starfighter was an 80s movie, but since then, movies about video games and the games themselves have morphed into something much more mainstream, much more socially interactive, and with totally awesome graphics. Baratunde Thurston is a Takeaway tech contributor and host of Popular Science's Future of, a TV show on the Science Channel. Also joining us on the line is Clive Thompson, technology writer and frequent contributor to Wired and the New York Times Magazine. Baratunde and Clive, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to be here.
So it seems to me we are far along in this video game era that I've sort of roughly traced here, Baratunde, to see some real permanent changes in human beings, both cognitively, socially, in all kinds of ways. What does the research say and what does it show?
Well, it sounds like there's sort of at least 5 benefits of video gaming. There's social, there's a sort of new storytelling format and the way of interacting with other people. It's a mental workout, it's fun, and there's also the ability to destroy things.
Right. Well, keeping the destroying things for a moment, is the mental workout idea supported by research and actual experience, Clive?
Yeah. There is some early research that suggests that we really do get some interesting things that happen. There's been studies, that, for example, to show that if you play Tetris a lot, it increases the white matter in your brain. And that is, when you have the more white matter in your brain, the more sort of efficient you are at doing
certain types of thinking. And there's been other studies that show that surgeons, you know, if they play laparoscopic surgeons, if they play video games before they do surgery, they actually have almost 40% fewer errors, because it's sort of getting their eye-hand coordination up to speed before they do a delicate task like that.
They've also been testing this on Parkinson's patients and people who have eye problems. But, you know, something that, Baratunde, that you mentioned, the social thing, is what brought me to the other side on video games, because I always had a prejudice against them growing up.
Oh, you're one of those.
I always imagined, you know, the 40-year-old, you know, playing in his mother's basement in his underwear. But my son is very much into them, so I decided to play World of Warcraft with him,
right,
to be involved in what he's doing. And I have to say, World of Warcraft, which is a multiplayer online game, mm-hmm, not only has these incredible social communities on it, but certain things you have to accomplish with groups of sometimes up to 25 people, and he's had to learn how to be a team player, or they won't invite him. He won't be able to get anything done.
You got reputation involved. It's a little society, and you learn to be a member of a society with the values and reputation and cost that goes along with that. And just a note on the 40-year-old living in his mother's basement. In this economy, that may not be such an outlander.
That's mainstream, exactly. Yeah. You know, in Second Life, there's an experience that they had with, and that's, of course, an online, not a video game, but it's an online interactive community of avatars, where stroke patients have actually gravitated to Second Life because it's a greater way, better way to communicate than they're able to do physically. In some sense, Baratunde and Clive jump in here. We shouldn't be surprised by this. I mean, pilots are trained in simulators. Astronauts are trained in simulators, right, Clive?
No, absolutely. I mean, the idea that games could affect your behavior is intuitive, because all sorts of areas have used them, to train people at doing things quickly. And the thing that's really interesting is that the research has started to branch out to look at sort of these very unexpected ways that games might be good for you. There's a piece that came out earlier this year that completely fascinated me, which is the idea that you could use Tetris to treat post-traumatic stress syndrome. Now, people think of PTSD as something that happens if you go to Iraq, but most often happens when you have a car accident. And so what they've discovered is that if you get someone to play Tetris for 45 minutes or so after a car accident, it might seriously decrease the amount of flashbacks they have, because essentially it occupies the visual cortex so much that you don't take all those flashback images of being in a car accident and read them into your brain as well.
So everybody who works in a cubicle who's been hiding their Tetris from their boss can now say, I'm therapy for my PTSD.
Oh, that's interesting.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting.
There is a danger here, though, and that's where I think parents get worried, is they don't want their kids sitting there for 9 hours on a Saturday playing a game instead of never getting outside, never actually non-virtually, like really interacting with people, college students who famously go to college, spend all their time playing games, and let their grades suffer.
Well, and also, if the games have such a good impact, Clive and Baratunde, we should be really worried about
real life.
The Miami Vice, what is it? Grand Theft Auto.
Right.
I mean, that really will have an impact.
Here's the thing. I mean, like, the video games are designed to be very addictive. I mean, people are paid tens of millions of dollars to make these things as addictive as possible. So it's absolutely true that the great danger with them is that you're just going to want, you'd rather play them than eat, you know, and that's absolutely true. So, I mean, like, you're absolutely right. That is a central danger with them. And brain training is sort of great up to a point. It should also be pointed out that there's, in addition to being some really good things that they're coming out in the research, there's a lot of very crappy pseudo research out there. This idea that these brain training games can, you know, prevent Alzheimer's and improve your mental facility when you're older.
Watch the marketing on the box. Okay, finally, you know, this great book, Ender's Game, posits that, in fact, video games are part of an entire universal simulation where we're all being watched and our skills are being monitored and we'll all be inducted into some sort of universal hero force. Do you buy that, Clive? I want to believe it's true.
Well, you know, this is the funny thing. When you talk about World of Warcraft sociability, there's a lot of companies now that when they go to hire someone, they say, well, we need someone that runs a World of Warcraft guild.
That's great. I do.
There we go.
It's great. Game. They're basically saying, we need someone who's already sat there in front of a computer and tried to organize 40 people all over the world using Skype.
Put it on Craigslist. Put it on Craigslist. Bartunde, take us out very quickly.
Two years of my college GPA suffering can attest to the fact that I was really training to save the human race.
That's fabulous. Bartunde Thurston, Takeaway tech contributor and host of Popular Science's Future Of. Thanks also to Clive Thompson, author of the science and technology blog, Collision Detection, frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine and Wired. So you didn't put that on your resume?
It's not on my resume, but I'm thinking maybe I should put that. I am the GM of a top rating guild in the World of Warcraft.
You need to call HR. This probably affects your pay grade.
That would be awesome. Yes. So I'm wondering what games people play to make them feel relaxed and better. I play World of Warcraft with my son. Here on the New York subways, you can see people playing Bejeweled. How about you? What do you play? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
What's your game, man?
We're also asking about the healthcare game. House Republicans are releasing their alternative to the Democratic healthcare reform bill. Let us know, what are the top three items you'd want to see in a final bill? Terry in Portsmouth, Rhode Island emails us, whatever plan they come up with, I want it to provide affordable healthcare for my employees. We've had to lay people off during these challenging economic times, and I have great concern for what happens to those people.
Thanks,
Give
Terry.
Us your take. Yeah, absolutely. 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And, you know, we've got all kinds of stuff on the website, including a new newsletter, an incredible newsletter. Jim Colgan's newsletter about next day's show. So get that at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. After months of simply opposing everything that the Democrats proposed in health care reform, the Republicans finally have a plan.
Number one, let families and businesses buy health insurance across state lines. Number two, allow individuals, small businesses, and trade associations to pull together and acquire health insurance at lower prices.
No public option, no restriction on pre-existing conditions.
Number three, give states the tools to create their own innovative reforms that lower health care costs.
Everything you want, plus tort reform and very little government involvement. The Minority Master Plan on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 5th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, state referenda on same-sex marriage. Voters say no once again in the state of Maine. When will advocates take no for an answer? We'll talk about that. The Storyteller as Historian, John Irving, talks to Celeste, and the Yankees won the series. Did I mention that the Yankees won the World Series?
You did mention it a couple times. But first, Congressman Eric Cantor, House Minority Whip and Republican from Virginia. Congressman, the Congressional Budget Office says the GOP plan will reduce the number of uninsured people by 3 million. That's essentially covering just about the same percentage of Americans as are covered now. So how is that effective reform?
Well, listen, I think the goal of any reform right now is to try and preserve what works in the system and then fix what doesn't. And we all started out hoping that we could achieve some reform that would actually reduce health care costs. Because if we reduce health care costs, more people will be able to access insurance coverage, more people would be able to have health care. And that's exactly what the Republican plan does. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office now has come out and validated our plan to say it actually does save health care costs for individuals who seek insurance.
Well, we'll get those details in just a moment. Representative Cantor, stay with us. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, just getting news in from the Associated Press that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says he won't run in January elections. That's what he told his political aides. He's expected to make a speech about it later today. New economic indicators out this past hour. 512,000 people claimed jobless benefits for the first time last week, a bigger drop than expected by about 20,000 people. The nation's retailers beginning to report October sales. Gap in Incorporated posted a 4% gain, helped by its sales at Old Navy. Meanwhile, the company that owns Victoria's Secret and Bath and Body Works reports a drop of 4%. The UN is temporarily moving 600 of its staff out of Afghanistan because of concerns for their safety after five UN workers were killed in an attack in Kabul last week.
Wall Street was mostly flat yesterday. The Dow's going to open at 9802. The S&P will start trade at 1047, and the NASDAQ will kick off at 2056. House Republicans, as we said, are releasing their alternative to the Democratic health bill. Bill, what do you want to see in the bill?
I'm Sean from Bradley Beach, and the one most important thing I'd like to see in the health care bill is competition, competition, competition. It's the one thing our insurance industry in healthcare doesn't really have.
What do you think it needs? 8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Speaking of health care, the Republican from Indiana, Mike Pence, said that the essential difference between the Democrats' health care plan and the Republican health care plan is in what they're planning to do.
Their focus is to get as close, presumably, to universal coverage as possible, and that's their every right to do. Republicans, listening to the American people back home, believe the real issue here is cost.
So bringing the cost down. Here to explain how they're planning to do that is Congressman Eric Cantor. He's the House Minority Whip from Virginia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Do you agree that the essential philosophical difference between your plan and that of the Democrats is that they're trying to get universal coverage, you're just trying to bring the costs of health insurance down?
No, I don't believe that. I believe that we Republicans want everyone to have access to health care as well. We just go about it in a different way, a much smarter, more reasoned approach. I think the goal that was set out by the president initially was we've got to bring down costs because the government cannot sustain its obligations under the health care programs that it pays for, Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, and the rest, given the cost trajectory, nor can individuals, small and large businesses, afford to pay the kind of health care premiums that they continue to have to pay given the increases. So what our bill does is it puts in place mechanisms to create competition and actually bring down costs. This is the primary difference between the Republican and the Democratic bills. The Congressional Budget Office came out yesterday, validated our claims that individuals, small groups, will be able to save up to 10% a year on their health care costs.
That's as collective. You're assuming that they're going to get sort of a collective bargaining discount.
No, that's not what I mean.
So
how
are you going to bring down the cost for an individual who's just trying to shop for insurance for themselves?
Well, number one, we're going to allow for cross state line purchases. So if I live in Virginia and there is a policy that fits my needs in the neighboring state of North Carolina and it is $100 cheaper, I'll be able to go and purchase that plan in North Carolina. That's
okay.
Impossible to do today. And what it will do is it will give an individual perhaps the opportunity to choose from 100 different insurance plans rather than maybe two or three that individuals have now, given the monopoly that insurance companies have in any given region.
Okay, but, you know, Congressman, just to play devil's advocate here, you know, for the millions of people who are uninsured, I don't think it's a question of cost. I don't think that saving $100 by shopping across state lines is going to help get those people insured. In other words, if someone's health care premium is $300 a month as opposed to $400 a month, for millions of people, that's going to make it possible for them to get health care insurance.
Well, let's look at what we're talking about in terms of what the uninsured actually means in this country. If you look at it, break it down roughly, there's a third of the uninsured, frankly, who are already eligible for existing government programs, and frankly, we haven't done a good job at trying to reach out and enroll those individuals. We need to do a better job in making sure that that happens to address that portion of the uninsured. There are also individuals who, frankly, maybe young, maybe looking to say, hey, I don't need insurance, I'm healthy, and decide to go without. And then what happens is they have an accident, and then they run into some real difficulties and can bankrupt themselves because they don't have insurance.
Those are the kind of people that we want to say, look, we're going to have a much more affordable option. There's going to be real competition. Washington's not going to decide for you what kind of insurance that you can have. We want you to have a pick of what kind of insurance meets you and your family's needs.
Okay, Congressman, on the question of cost then, does the Republican caucus support requiring pharmaceutical companies to be reimbursed for their products at the lower Medicare rate rather than what's currently done, allowing market forces to set prices for certain reimbursements?
What we've seen in Medicare Part D, where Medicare beneficiaries have experienced access to pharmaceutical benefits, is real price competition, and that we want to continue to see that. We want to continue to see folks having access to the lowest cost price. What we don't want to see is government fixing of prices, because that's what's going on now.
But and wouldn't that actually reduce costs, Congressman, save $80 billion?
No, it would not, because somebody's got to pay for it somewhere. The government can't come in by fiat and insist that a product be charged at a certain price. Where's the money going to come from? What's happening now in the healthcare system, and this is what the Democratic bill does in terms of all healthcare services. It says the government thinks that things are too expensive, so we're going to put a cap on those expenses. Well, you know what? That's the way the current system works in many instances. So there's cost shifting going on, and that's why the 85% of Americans that have insurance now think it's too expensive, because the government is saying we're just not going to pay anymore. Where does the money come from? It doesn't come out of thin air. It comes from people's taxes. It comes from people's paycheck. That's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid the fact that we cannot have access to health care because it's becoming too expensive.
There are four main priorities that we saw on the Republican health care plan priorities. The fourth one was to end junk lawsuits and medical malpractice lawsuits. And I want to talk to you about that one, because recent very, very good research has shown us that medical malpractice makes up only 2% of U.S. health spending. So how is tort reform in health care going to bring down the cost of health care?
Well, Celeste, I think the Congressional Budget Office would differ with your conclusion there, because the Congressional Budget Office said...
That's actually the 2004 report from the Congressional Budget Office said medical malpractice makes up only 2% of U.S. health spending.
The Congressional Budget Office report several weeks ago indicates that the government alone in Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, and the rest would have a reduced cost of $54 billion in terms of medical liability reform, real medical liability reform. So that's number one. But what we also want to do is we want to address the fact that no one should have to go without insurance if they find themselves with a pre-existing condition. And we address that fact in our bill. And we do so without increasing costs, which is another difference between the Republican and the Democratic plan.
Now, explain
we
that.
Also say...
Wait,
we
before
also
you...
Say
but before... Before you leave the pre-existing conditions, from what I understood from the Republican health care plan, you are not barring insurance companies from refusing coverage because of a pre-existing condition.
Celeste, what we're doing is we are requiring states to set up universal access programs so that if individuals find themselves with a pre-existing condition and are re-upping their insurance policy or seeking new insurance and they cannot get it at an affordable rate, their insurance company will be required to go into a reinsurance pool set up at all the states funded by the federal government, putting $25 billion into those pools. That insurance company will seek reinsurance, and the beneficiary of the or the holder of the policy will not even know a difference, because it's his or her rates will be subsidized by the government in that instance.
Well, that's government-imposed influence in the market. It's just state government.
No, it is federal government subsidized with the states and the participation of the insurance company. We've got to have a safety net there for individuals with pre-existing conditions, and that is the mechanism, in fact, that the Democratic bill sets up before their government takeover of the bill. They address that by the same way we do. But you know what the difference is? The difference is that the Democratic bill is a $1 trillion overhaul and puts us on a path to a government takeover. The Republican bill costs $61 billion. $1 billion, and over the period will save the federal government $68 billion. This is what we need right now in America. We can't, we cannot keep spending money.
Congressman, the people up in the 23rd District of New York weren't buying the government takeover argument. The conservative got his head handed to him up there. This draconian argument doesn't really fly.
Well, you know, I don't think that that's a correct analysis of what went on in New York 23. I think the elections on Tuesday demonstrated that if the Republican Party is united, whether we're running in a northern state or southern state, we can win, and we can even win in a very Democratic state like New Jersey. When we are divided, obviously we can lose a race in a congressional district that has and should be a Republican seat.
I have to ask Congressman Eric Cantor of Virginia, the Republican bill doesn't really have a chance of passing. So instead of coming up with a separate plan from the Democrats, why not take your ideas to them and help to alter the debate on the current Democratic health care plan that may get passed?
Well, we have tried consistently to do that, and despite all the claims of working across the partisan aisle, neither the White House nor any Democratic leader in Congress has done anything of the sort. Mm-hmm. I will say that I have met several times with Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, who has been one to try at least have some meetings.
Well, maybe your proposal now is going to bring the Democrats back to the table. We'll see if that'll spark some dialogue. That's Congressman Eric Cantor, Republican from Virginia, the House Minority Whip, talking about the Republicans' alternative health care plan proposal. It's whip week on The Takeaway. We're going to have House Majority Whip James Clyburn on The Takeaway tomorrow morning. And we're asking you, if you are putting together a health care bill, what are the top three things that you would include in your health care plan? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
A thoughtful takeout to begin this morning. We want to alert you to something that's going on our website. In this economy, how can you choose between getting a job you love and even having a job at all? It can be tough. But our friend and correspondent Farai Chidea is producing a series for us exploring that issue. We're calling it The Value. It's about how people's priorities change with the uncertain economy and how people start deciding what matters to them, maybe more than money. For the latest installment of The Value, Farai spoke with someone who works at a community garden in the Bronx here in New York City. Jared Vazalez says his values made him pick a career that lets him work in the outdoors in a city, helping residents grow their own produce.
If you can get them out here involved in those experiences, and then they walk away at the end of the day feeling a lot better about themselves, which is difficult when you're at a desk job and you're just, you know, punching in numbers or something like that. At the end of the day, you may be wondering, what did I do today? And here, you know, you really see the benefits of the effort you're putting into it.
People talk about green jobs, they talk about urban gardening, but on a practical level, is this the kind of career that is able to sustain you in a city as expensive as New York?
You know, I've been here 2 years, so in that sense, I'm surviving. My priorities have always been feed the soul first, feed the wallet second. And so, you know, this is a great fit.
That's Farai Chidea speaking to Jared Vazalez in the Target Bronx Community Garden for our series, The Value. And what, you know, Farai's really exploring here is how the recession is an opportunity for lots of people to step back and take an inventory of what they're values actually are.
In some case, forcing them to take a step back and make those choices.
And the numbers are different than simply adding up amounts of money in bank accounts, et cetera. And so we want you to go to the website. You can hear more of that interview that Farai did and watch a video of Jared and Farai in the garden in the Bronx at thetakeaway.org. And if you choose a job based on your own values, we want to hear from you. Fill us your inventory of values at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Last week, Farai spoke to someone who spent all his savings on an adventure in Antarctica.
I will probably by the end of it have spent about $12,000 or $13,000. I had to start a financial vehicle in the summer of 2008 and save for a year and a half basically to be able to pay for it, but I think it's well worth it.
Is he nuts? Well, Gretchen from New York City didn't think so.
My family is going to Madagascar in December. I have two young children, and my husband is from Madagascar, so it's been really important for us to make that trip so our children can meet their grandparents and cousins there. But of course, it's costing us about $13,000 to go on this trip. But unfortunately, we're not in the position of your young single man, and we're not able to save that money. We've had to put it all on credit cards. Yet we live extremely simply here in New York. We never have that latte. We never go out for meals. And so it's a bit discouraging, but we're still willing to take that risk and make up the money when we can, because a trip like this is something that's very, very important.
Can survival be an adventure in these economic times? Check out all the videos for our value series at thetakeaway.org. Get involved by calling thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Here's something that people think has value, a World Series championship, right? Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway, our sports contributor, we got the 27th championship for the Yankees last night.
They won in wonderful fashion, 7-3. And I think they did the only thing that politics can't do. They united the city. In 1986, the Mets won the World Series against the Boston Red Sox, and it united all of the baseball fans against the Red Sox. Well, in 2009, this is united New York City versus the Phillies, where all the Mets fans for the first time for the first time they could root for the Yankees. Tomorrow,
yeah.
Six of them did.
I'm sorry, but. I mean, I'm a newcomer to New York, but one thing I have noticed is that there's a lot of people in New York. There's a lot of Yankees fans, but there's the other half that really don't like them at all.
I saw a lot of Mets fans with Mets caps rooting for the Yankees. That's where this is coming from. So I think it was doing something that you couldn't do in the election day yesterday.
You make an interesting point, though, about uniting the city. Because the last time, the Yankees were in the series in 01.
Correct.
After 9/11 and didn't win. And a lot of people said they should have won because it would have united the city. I actually felt a breath last night from 9/11, from winning in 2009. It put something in the past, it seemed to me.
There was a lot of pressure on all of the players, some of the players like Alex Rodriguez, Hideki Matsui, some of the guys that were brought in with big money contracts that were brought in to win a World Series and hadn't done it. And that really, you could see in Alex Rodriguez's face, he just looked like a 9-year-old boy.
But how do you answer the critics that you hear so often saying, of course they won, they spend millions of dollars on their lineup. What's not surprising is that they won, but that they didn't win for the 8 years before this.
Well, it just speaks to the fact that money cannot buy a championship. You have to have a mixture of chemistry. You have to have people that have the guts and the passion to make it happen. And those previous Yankee teams, it just simply was not their year. And it's always a mixture. Maybe it is like the veteran's going to win, or maybe the young youthful energy is going to win. This year, the Yankees came together as a team, and you consistently heard that every single time they talked about it, that it was a team that came together.
Okay. And a lot of those players will just be traded away.
Yeah, we've got a lot of free agents coming up that may not be on the team as of next year. That's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
And we go to Louise Story now for our final takeout. This morning, Louise, let's talk about a big announcement from the FHA, and then suddenly the announcement was like put in the drawer. What's going on
here?
The FHA is driving home mortgages right now. And you've mentioned that on the program before.
We've talked about them because the Federal Housing Administration is an agency that guarantees mortgages made usually to lower income people or first-time home buyers, and they've really stepped in and backed the housing market in the last 2 years when no one else would lend. But unfortunately, they've made a ton of bad loans. They've taken over a lot of the subprime loans. A lot of people think they're in trouble. So we were all eagerly awaiting this report that they were supposed to release last night from an independent auditor, which the head of the FHA has told me was going to show that they're just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, the report didn't come out. They didn't explain why. They said there were some unexplained problems, and they canceled the press conference today about this report. So it's really raised even more suspicion about what's happening at this agency.
And does the FAA operate like a bank? Does it have specific sort of capital requirements that if they sort of disclose, hey, here we are, and it's not true, that they're in trouble, like, say, an AIG or a Citigroup?
They do have all kinds of reserve requirements, and that's what we've been talking about when people say the FHA needs a bailout. We're talking about whether their capital reserves are enough to cover the losses that they're expecting, because, get this, they've said that one out of every four loans that they've backed from 07 and 08 may run run into trouble. Wow. It's a huge amount.
And we've already talked about, you've mentioned a couple of times, the burn rate at the FDIC, which yep. backs banks. So what is the total amount of mortgage lending that the FAA is responsible for? How big of a number are we talking about, even ballpark?
They have millions and millions of loans, and they've really stepped up. And just the last year, they've guaranteed 2 million home purchases and refinancings. And so they're really running a lot of the market.
And so when we look at these housing statistics that yep. are bouncing along the bottom, the FHA is trying to get them off the bottom. If something happens here and we find out that things are really dire
it's
at the FHA,
it's a concerted effort to help the market.
It's a big consumer story. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. There's your takeout. Coming up, we're going to go to Maine and talk about the referendum in Maine and what it means for gay marriage and advocates of legalization of gay marriage.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, where does Maine's vote on gay marriage stand for advocates who have to decide what to do next? Maine, of course, voted down the gay marriage law on Tuesday. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says he won't run in January elections because of the lack of progress in peace talks with Israel, is what he told his political aides, and Abbas is expected to make a speech about it later today. Economic indicators out this past hour, we learned that 512,000 people claimed jobless benefits last week for the first time, and markets are rallying on the news. That's less than expected.
The New York Yankees won the World Series in the Bronx last night. They beat the Phillies 7-3. German workers are staging strikes outside Opel's headquarters in Germany. Opel is a subsidiary of General Motors. They're protesting GM's decision not to sell its European operations. GM says it'll restructure the business instead and cut around 10,000 jobs across Europe. And finally, President Obama is going to meet with American Indian tribal leaders today. He hopes to improve the federal government's relationship with Indian tribes. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
And now the voters have spoken once again in Maine, voting to reject a law that legalized same-sex marriage in the state of Maine. It's not the first time voters in states around the country have rejected same-sex marriage or gay marriage referenda if they've been put on the ballot. More than 30 times has this happened. So the question, and I pose it at the top of the hour, is when do advocates take no for an answer? Where do we go from here? Joining us now to talk about both the emotional and strategic stakes in what to do next regarding same-sex marriage advocates is Suzanne Goldberg, Columbia University law professor and director of the Gender and Sexuality Law Program. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Jill Barkley joins us, a resident of Portland, Maine, who planned to marry her partner next summer. And, of course, those plans are disrupted, at least if she's going to have the marriage there in Maine. Jill Barkley, good morning.
Good morning.
And Andrew McLean, a resident of Gorham, Maine, volunteered with Equality Maine, and he also has his own personal stake in the outcome. Jill and Andrew, did you feel emotionally connected to this verdict? A majority of people who went to the polls in Maine said no to what it is that, Jill, you're planning to do.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of emotion involved right now. Obviously, it's a heartbreaking loss, but I think it's also important to remember that almost half of the voters that went to the polls voted for these rights to be bestowed on same-sex couples here, and I think that that is something that we could continue to work for.
Although it has no legal standing, even though it's a silver lining, I suppose. Andrew McLean, where do you go from here?
It is a very, very, it was a very, very sad day yesterday. But the fact remains is that there are thousands of gay and lesbian couples who are still denied those basic rights that come along with marriage. And we have to wait another couple of years to hopefully get on board with another campaign to get those rights.
Suzanne Goldberg, is it possible that the campaigns themselves are creating a body of law which explicitly forbids same-sex marriage that may complicate the civil rights implications of trying to enforce legally some sort of national tolerance of this practice?
Actually, I think what the campaigns tell us is that the tipping point is in sight, that for people who want marriage equality for same-sex couples, the glass is nearly half full. And if we look at the campaigns, not just in the moment, but in a sort of broader frame, what we see is that the change has been steady and that it's really, I think, just a matter of time, a short amount of time probably, before we get to the point where gay and lesbian couples can marry freely.
And at what point is doing this over and over again, Jill Barkley, a bad strategy for advocates nationally?
I'm not sure. I think that in Maine, you know, this was our first go, and we definitely had a very successful legislative campaign. We passed the bill through our Senate, our House, our governor signed it, and so many Mainers came out to say that they do support marriage equality. So I think a second round is definitely not a bad idea. I think it's a good idea, and I think that it could be winnable.
And why do ballot measures work here? I mean, Andrew McLean, Celeste has mentioned on this program a number of times that civil rights was not a ballot measure in Mississippi to integrate public schools. If that was our mechanism, we'd still probably have slavery in the United States.
Definitely
Andrew?
Have segregation.
I think it's a very good point. You know, any time that we subject people's rights to a people's veto, for instance, in Maine, history tells us that it doesn't work. You know, we would still, Brown versus Board of Education would not have happened. We would not have had desegregation if it was put up for a popular vote, you know. So I think that's what we get into a lot of trouble in this country when we put up people's rights for a vote.
Well, Suzanne, that's the question. As we were just saying, you know, the people of the United States are not historically very good at granting rights by popular vote. So at this point, could this fight be taken better simply to courts and legislatures rather than constantly putting it on the ballot?
It seems to me that the fight happens on all fronts, right? It is happening in courts, it is happening in legislatures, and at the ballot. And it's also true that there's a very long history, including in the 1960s, of voters taking away anti-race discrimination protections from that had been passed by legislatures. But I think what we see and what's gained from these ballot measures, however they come out, is that the conversation starts to change in important ways, and that the numbers of people, at least in Maine, who are envisioning and willing to straightforward say yes to marriage equality for same-sex couples, those numbers are growing and will continue to grow as a result of the ballot battles.
Yet it might not be responsible to preempt the debate. I mean, there is an alternative view, and the reason we're having this discussion is that it was voted down in Maine. Is the fact that no national figure, let's say, for instance, Barack Obama, weighed in Maine to try to change the vote and indicate this could be a national issue, does that prejudice the case of this becoming a civil rights issue that might actually find its way before the Supreme Court?
It would, of course, be helpful if the president would speak clearly and forthrightly, as he did during the campaign against discrimination, and now to speak forthrightly in favor of the end of marriage discrimination. But apart from the president, there are plenty of figures, both national and local, in every jurisdiction and around the country who are speaking out. And again, I think what we've seen is that number was fairly small just a few years ago, and it has ballooned so that the cultural conversation, along with the political, the legislative, and the judicial conversations are changing.
All right, finally, take us out to Jill Barkley. When you walk down the street, numerically, there's a pretty good chance that half of the people disapprove of your lifestyle and your plans to get married. How does that make you feel based on this vote?
That's heartbreaking to think of it that way. Definitely my partner and I are in our late 20s, and we really wanted a legal civil marriage now. What breaks my heart more is thinking about the couples who really can't wait for these rights, who are older, facing health concerns, need to visit each other in the hospital.
And it's a long road ahead for all of them. Jill Barkley, Andrew McLean, and Susan Goldberg. Suzanne Goldberg, Columbia Law Professor. Jill Barkley, resident of Portland, Maine, who planned to marry her partner next summer. And Andrew McLean, a gay resident of Portland, of Gorham, Maine, who volunteered with Equality Maine. Thanks to all of you for that discussion. Coming up, John Irving talks about getting advice and giving advice, and history and storytelling, all wrapped up into one great conversation with Celeste.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Developing story now. Information is coming in. Aides to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are saying that Abbas received calls today from Israel's president and defense minister, the president of Egypt, and the king of Jordan, all asking him to reconsider a decision he hasn't even disclosed publicly. The Associated Press broke this morning the story that Mahmoud Abbas has told his political aides he won't run in January elections, and the reason has to do with his frustration with the peace process with Israel. A speech later today may clarify things, but joining us is Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. He served as an advisor on the Middle East to both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. Aaron David Miller, first of all, good morning.
Morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a disheartening development, or is it a strategic gambit on the part of President Mahmoud Abbas?
You know, I spent a lot of time with this guy over the last 10 years. He's basically a good man with all the right intentions and instincts trapped in a hopeless situation. And part of him has always not wanted to be involved in Palestinian politics, but most of him is motivated by a sense of duty and obligation. I just think, frankly, that this is a sign of profound frustration. He's, after all, the guy is trapped, really, in a triangle. On one hand, he's got Hamas, and he's presiding over a kind of a Palestinian Humpty Dumpty. The Palestinian national movement is broken.
Right.
On the other hand, he's dealing with a tough Israeli prime minister whose conception of how a Palestinian state might evolve is fundamentally different than his. And then the third point of the triangle is actually quite new and interesting. It's the Obama administration, who seems to have been, to some degree, tone-deaf with respect to its sensitivities to understanding Abbas's current situation.
Well, let's clarify that for a second. I mean, in some sense, the message here is, despite a speech in Cairo, Egypt, visits by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to the region, and the appointment of George Mitchell as this czar to try to oversee Middle East peace, Mahmoud Abbas says it's amounted to nothing. Is that what you're gleaning from this?
Well, what I'm suggesting is the administration first came out of the box being very tough with the Israelis and quite sensitive to Arab and Palestinian concerns. Now they have apparently flip-flopped and have taken a much tougher line with respect to Palestinian needs and requirements. They want him back to the negotiating table. And they've been much more sensitive to Israeli needs and requirements. Frankly, I think that they don't have the balance right in either dealing with the Israelis or the Palestinians, which is one of the reasons they find themselves 10 months into the administration as the clock ticks down on the first year of the president's presidency, stuck. Hmm. Well, and Abbas is the weakest party, the weakest reed in the equation.
Is it possible, and we have less than a minute here, he says he won't run in January elections. Can we interpret that as a deadline of January to do something substantive, or he's not going to participate?
I think the elections, John, themselves are a ploy. I think they were designed to have him gain attention, re-grab the initiative. I don't think resignation under these circumstances is an option. The fact is he, like the President of the United States, is stuck. He can't fix the situation, and he can't run away from it. And as 2009 becomes 2010, I suspect that's the situation we're going to be dealing with.
Well, we'll see what the Obama administration assessment of being stuck is. That's reactions are going to come out later today. Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, talking about apparently Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to not run in January elections in the Palestinian Authority. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk to John Irving, the award-winning novelist, has a new book, and we're going to talk to him about his book and whether he can take his own advice in just a moment. All day today, we're also talking about health care. House Republicans are releasing their alternative to Democratic health care reform this week, and we've been asking you what would be in your health care bill. What would be your top priority?
I want to see a health care bill come out that does not mandate health insurance, just lower health care costs.
I'd like health insurance policies written so they are understandable before you are in the middle of using them and realize that so many things are not covered.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. As we've been discussing, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has told political aides he will not run in January's elections. He's expected to make a speech about that later today, explaining his decision. In Washington, the Democrats on a key Senate panel have approved a climate change bill without any Republicans present. The bill would require industries to cut emissions by 20% by the year 2020. Republicans have boycotted the committee's work, saying more analysis is needed. And the Northwest Airline pilots who overshot Minneapolis by 150 miles are appealing to get their pilot licenses back. The FAA revoked their licenses last month, saying the pilots put the passengers on board the flight in serious danger. The pilots say they just lost track of time while working on the computers.
California has released a report harshly reprimanding state corrections officers for their monitoring of convicted sex offender Philip Garrido. He's the man charged with the abduction, rape, and 18-year-long imprisonment of J.C. Dugard. Matthew Cade is Secretary of California's Department of Corrections. He spoke to CBS News this morning.
The department's obligation today is to try to take each one of these missteps and try to learn from it and make sure that our agents are aware of these kind of circumstances so that we can do our best to make sure it doesn't happen again.
The report says Philip Garrido was wrongly classified as low risk. Looking ahead to tomorrow, the unemployment rate for October will be out. It's expected to go above 10%, but markets are rallying this morning on unemployment news, surprisingly down. First-time claims for unemployment down 20,000 claims, and also retail sales mixed bag, but positive for people on Wall Street. And finally, for all our British listeners out there, happy Guy Fawkes Day. For all of those of you who don't know, it's November 5th, 1605. Guy Fawkes attempted to blow up the British Parliament. His plot was foiled, but Brits still mark the day with fireworks and bonfires in which they burn effigies of Fawkes. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
John Irving is the author of lots of books you've heard of and have seen movies based off of, including The World According to Garp, The Cider House Rules, and A Prayer for Owen Meany. His newest book is called Last Night on Twisted River. It follows one character and his father over the course of 50 years. The character is a writer, and he's also a fugitive, and John's with us here today to talk about his new novel and what makes for good characters. John Irving, first of all, thanks so much for coming in. And I know that in the book you complain about media asking you about your connection with the characters you write about, but still I have to ask you, what parts of your stories don't come from your personal experiences at all? What parts of your characters and your novels come purely from your imagination?
Well, this is the third novel where a main character is a writer. That was true in The World According to Garp. It was true in A Widow for 1 Year. But to be fair, I beg the autobiographical question in this novel because I have given to the character of Danny, as faithfully as I can, what my actual process as a writer is. What I haven't given to Danny is my life. Danny's life is not what's happened to me, but everything I fear happening to me. Danny's life is not about things that have happened to me, but things I hope never happen to me. And I would argue in the autobiographical realm that when a writer writes obsessively as I do, not about what has happened to him, but what he most fears happening to himself or to people he loves, I would say that that is more truthfully or tellingly, emotionally autobiographical than those easy-to-identify landmarks, which are the facts of my life that match up to the facts of Danny's life.
I read where you talked about this novel and you said that it was at heart a novel about appreciating the people in our lives before we lose them. And this book is full of loss. I mean, there's a death on the first page, and people lose people in all different ways, sometimes just by losing touch. I know at one point one of the characters says, I can't believe I look back and it's been 7 years since I talked to this person. So sometimes it's not death, but other ways that people lose touch. And I'm wondering, why that particular theme? What made that such an important thing that you wrote a whole book about, the ways that people deal with losing the important people in their lives?
Well, it's a fugitive story. It's about a father and his 12-year-old son who, because of a violent act, are fleeing, running for their lives for 50 years. And so this boy from the age of 12 is afraid he's going to lose his father. He will. When his only child is born, he fears for all the terrible things that might happen to a child, as any parent with an imagination does. Everything Danny is afraid of comes true. There's no secret in this novel about what's going to happen. The secret is how long do they have before the cowboy catches up to them, and When's he going to catch up to them, and where?
And exactly how the guillotine will fall.
Exactly how, yeah.
You know, and it also struck me, because this book felt so much like a legacy book, like this is the result of John Irving's experience in relationships, it struck me that there aren't any successful, long-lasting, loving relationships. Nobody in here seems to be happily married with a relationship that lasts through the obstacles of time and life. Why is that?
Well, I don't know that happily married is such an interesting story. I'm happily married, but I can't imagine writing a novel about it, or I can't imagine there'd be many people interested in that story. Unhappiness, loneliness, being deprived of something, losing something, these are much more compelling stories.
But there is this very eloquent message to appreciate your beloved one while you have them, to give the time to those that you love while they're still in your presence, and not to worry about the future. Because to a certain extent, Danny and his father are crippled by the fact that they're always worried, they're always in fear. And I'm wondering if you, John Irving the person, not John Irving the writer, have learned that lesson, the one that you seem to be teaching in this novel.
Well, it's one thing to be able to give other people advice, but it's quite a different matter to be able to take it yourself. You know, the imagination, unfortunately, isn't a faucet. I've often thought that I would be more content and less anxious as a father if when I left my office at the end of the day, I could somehow leave my imagination under the desk with whatever I was writing. But, you know, it doesn't work that way. Maybe one of the reasons I'm such a workaholic as a writer, one of the reasons that I love to work 8 or 9 hours a day, 7 days a week, is that I feel relatively safe when I'm visiting the horrors and perversities of my imagination on my characters. But when I leave my office, I have nothing to do but obsess about, is the dog all right? Or is this or that of my children all right? No, I can't take my own advice. That's probably why I keep giving it.
Well, it's a really enjoyable book. Thank you so much, John Irving. New book is called Last Night in Twisted River.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to re-listen to that or anything you missed on the program, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for the Takeaway newsletter. This is going to change your life. While you're there, you'll get a heads up on the next day's show. It's all kinds of, I mean, you have problems in your life, read the newsletter at thetakeaway.org. It's Whip Week on The Takeaway. We talked to the Republican Minority Whip Eric Cantor about his party's own health care bill. Re-listen to that. They're going to plan to unveil that plan this week. Our D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick says a vote on the House Democrats' version could be Saturday. So we'll ask House Majority Whip James Clyburn on The Takeaway tomorrow. Tune in for that. And we're also asking you, with the Republicans' version on the horizon, what do you want to see in this bill?
My name is Chuck from South Carolina. We should have a very strong public option. I think there should be absolutely no wiggle room for insurance companies to refuse people for pre-existing conditions, and I think we should get 100% of all Americans covered.
Well, this is your moment to give advice to all of the whips, Republican and Democrat. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Do a little whipping of your own and give us, let us know what you care about in healthcare. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.